Blog Talk Radio.
Version of tissues forming organisms like particles splitting. I'm volatile, be wary of me. The spawn of the sun and the earth, be born on hollow ground. Messed around and open up a goddamn portal spitting. They call me beast because I'm greasing rappers on their turf and plot revolts. They'll quote me later, say I hardly spoke. Cause I'm a quiet assassin with passion for fire. Blaze the trails and leave the victims catching breath inside the smoke. This the revival left that fiber rap, Harlem City. Epitome of street survival rap, hard and gritty. A law's math with a swag that can't master. Cast from the plaza of the Elohim, God is with me. I spark fear in their hearts with 50,000 watts of light beams from out the deepest chasms of the darkness. Each verse I leave my mark and they say they can't mark it. But these are gemstones, bezel cut, lane and gold copper. Language so proper, I enunciate the doctrine, taking converts. You wonder why my name is so popular. I came from a jungle made of concrete and conflict. Liars and them tigers and them bears held us hostage. Where I learned the difference between authentic and imposters. Where I turned my sentences to loaded guns and cocked them. There I stayed alone, beware of sinisters and monsters. Now I'm plaguing fingers in the center of a mosh pit. I'm the center of your conscience. The black dot, honey skin, the pinnacle of progress. The future of music is brighter than the solar flare. I'm blacker than Garvey, you whiter than the polar bear. Hold it there, you don't want a saucer with the holy veil. Box the crowd and leave my mic like artifacts, holy grail. Matter of fact, you can call me the prophet. I'm probably you, Ali incarnate, so stop it. This is a letter to them veterans and garlic ninjas who fought blood wars, shots leading bodies crippled. I'm trying to catch them before they end up as a homie victim. Guess you call me pastor, saving cats with the phonic system. They burn a block because I'm not like these regular broads. Speak revelations off the top like I'm channeling God. And my sister's keeper, bell hooks and Audre Lorde. Ask about me, I protect the goddess with katana swords. I'm type ill like I'm typhoid, no vaccine. You a hypochondriac, I live rap, you practicing. I break rules like white boys in courtrooms. Where that cracker George at? The bounty something that make moves. I'm sort of the rapper, the half the game been waiting on. The other half is waiting to see who next they hating on. But it don't matter cause I'm bred tough in carbon form. Give you plus lessons, then you see how knowledge born. Ha, ha.
I'ma wrong if I wanna get it on till I die. Bustin' cool, got a nigga duckin' zones in the sky. Home alone, but you know I got my dogs by my side. In the zone, getting money, making music, getting out, yeah.
Warring for peace, and peace after war.
Jump in the car and lie for me. God's inside of me, though the devil's on the side of me. Hit a nigga in his shoulder, make him show the lead. When we beefing, it ain't over when we throw them things. For the money, we gon' scheme, no joke, team. For the team, we gon' play, life is but a dream. Could see it in their eyes, how the police has noticed me. I know my grandmother's spirit be watching over me.
Warring for peace.
Peace after war. Now I'm talking it, middle finger to the government. Out in public, I be on some other shit. Looking fresh as hell like I hit a lick.
Screw your bitch face, hit it with the pit of dick.
I'm wrong if I wanna get it on till I die. Bustin' chrome, got a nigga duckin' zones in the sky. Home alone, but you know I got my dog by my side. In the zone, getting money, making music, getting hot, yeah.
Warring for peace, and peace after war.
Peace after war.
Steady warming for peace, I never turn my cheek unless I'm up with some cheeks and steady eating deep. When that phone starts ringing, you know I gotta go. No, I ain't bullshitting, you know I'm out the dough. Girl, I know how I know. When you give it to me, I just take it like a pro. I love the way you get back, time to get back to that dough. I'm never lacking, I be on some shit you never know.
I'm warring for peace, and peace after war.
Peace after war.
Warring for peace, and peace after war.
If I got static, I don't tell nobody. Know I'm fly, run down on them like I need a pilot. Hopping out, styling, I don't need no stylist. Niggas stay wildin' like I'm cool with
I'm
Onyx.
Wrong if I wanna get it on till I die. Bustin' chrome, got a nigga duckin' zones in the sky. Home alone, but you know I got my dog by my side. In the zone, getting money, making music, getting hot, yeah.
Warring for peace, and peace after war.
Man, you hear this bullshit they be talking? Every day, man, it's like these motherfuckers is just like professional liars, you know what I'm saying? Wow. Listen, Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects. It was your nigga. Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga. Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects.
From the American Bankers Association, this is the ABA Banking Journal Podcast. Welcome back. I'm Evan Sparks, and I'm here today to talk about everyone's favorite topic, bank accounting. To do that, I have Josh Stein and Mike Gallette. They are both experts in bank accounting here at ABA, working in our working with financial institutions on bank accounting policy. So Josh and Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So a few weeks ago, we had an episode on the LIBOR transition, which was our most downloaded so far of season two. And so we're going to get similarly wonky today and talk about CECL, the current expected credit loss model or standard for loan loss accounting that is currently vexing a lot of bank management teams and CFOs and confusing some other people. So, you know, a lot of bankers know what this is. This has been, you know, issued by the Federal Financial Accounting Standards Board back in 2016 and was discussed for a long time prior to that. And kind of what's the state of play in the transition to this this new standard?
Well, we probably only have a few minutes to talk here. I think you asked about two hours worth of questions here, but it's top of the mind because it's about what banks do. They lend.
Yeah.
Okay, and this is the measurement of credit losses at a specific point in time. And because of that, it affects their capital. And when anything affects bank capital, it affects how much banks can lend, how much they can provide for dividends or what have you. The allowance for credit losses is the biggest estimate that a bank will have on their balance sheet. And, you know, we made some estimates back like from 2015 that if you just change your estimate by 10%, that would have pretty much wiped out or doubled your pre-tax income at the time. So it has a very large impact on bank financial statements, you know, whether it's a quarterly report, whether it's the capital, or whether it's ongoing net income.
Yeah, and it's also not just a uniform impact. There isn't a lot of knowledge out there on, because this changes the economics of bank lending, what the impacts are going to be on specific products or specific borrowers, and you know how that impacts you know, the availability of credit. So it's not just a bank issue, right? It's also an issue for the broader economy.
Yeah, and just to, you know, level set for listeners who aren't as familiar with this topic, I mean, what we're talking about is an approach to calculating credit loss that requires losses to be booked at the time the loan is made, not to not when the losses are actually realized. Is that right? Is that a fair summary?
It makes the time of booking those losses earlier. So in the current model, you in theory book them when they're probable. We can have a separate 5-hour debate on what the incurred methodology actually is, but it does force banks to recognize credit loss earlier, and because they have to recognize it at the time of origination, it puts strain on your ability to lend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that it's important, though, that in theory, banks will book losses earlier. How much more they would book earlier is still in doubt because of the requirement to forecast in the future what your economic conditions are. Economic conditions throughout the U.S. are normally pretty favorable or stable.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're stable, banks record very little losses. But then, you know, once every several years, dozen years or what have you, the economic variables or, you know, the economy pretty much is unfavorable. The economy tanks.
Mm-hmm.
How do you put that into your forecast? So,
and even some of the most sophisticated modelers, economic modelers out there, have missed big, you know, have missed even some small elements that drive the model that result in massive, you know, errors in terms of what the economic outlook's going to be.
And that's a great point, particularly when you think about consensus forecasting, the ability to understand ahead of time when the market's going to turn or what the inflection point is going to be is not a strength.
I would even go so far as that you're wrong in saying that you know, most of the organizations have had problems with it. All of the organizations, all forecasting organizations have.
So, and then when we do get in.
How to sign your signature without liability. An overview. Big Brother's master plan to subjugate the entire human race is utterly dependent on people continuing to volunteer for and finance their own enslavement. Without such largesse from the public, the chosen masters face certain calamity and exposure for their crimes. Heretofore, system operatives have been overwhelmingly successful at duping unwitting victims into volunteering for virtually every kind of financial ill imaginable. And make no mistake, it is purely voluntary. The system is working exactly as it is designed to do, and the chroniclers of chaos proudly trumpet their statistics as they inch forward in their dreams of total world domination. It is no coincidence that the introduction and popularity of the real estate board game Monopoly parallels the history of the money changers' financial conquest of America, culminating with its copyright by Parker Brothers in 1935. The same time that we were converted over from a substance gold-backed currency to a belief credit-backed currency.
On the 31st of December 1935, the board game Monopoly was patented. Although the patent for the game was awarded to Charles B. Darrow, a Philadelphia heating salesman who had lost his job during the Great Depression, it's now widely recognized that Darrow was just one of many people who led to the development of the complex design and rules that we now know as Monopoly. As early as 1902, an Illinois-born writer and engineer called Lizzie Maggi created a board game that she referred to as the Landlord's Game, and which bore striking similarities to the later Monopoly. She patented this game in 1904 and approached Parker Brothers with the idea in around 1910. Although that board game manufacturer declined to publish it, her self-produced copies became popular with Quakers, university students, and members of the public who supported Georgist economics. Maggi, by now married and with the new name Phillips, repatented an updated version of the game in 1924, when she was again turned down by Parker Brothers. However, the updated version spread widely through word of mouth, and Charles Darrow's wife eventually learned about it. Darrow began to copy and distribute his own version of the game, and in October 1934 was himself rejected by Parker Brothers, who found his game too complicated, too technical, and that it took too long to play. However, successful Christmas sales of Darrow's game led Parker Brothers to reverse their decision and bought the game from Darrow in March 1935. Before the end of the year, they learned that he was not the sole inventor, but they pressed ahead with the purchase and helped him to secure a patent, while they bought up the patents to similar games, including the Landlord's Game, to ensure that they had definitive ownership of the whole idea.
The game's logo even confesses the caricature of a white mustachioed English banker, complete with top hat, tails, and cane. The objective in the board game of Monopoly is to drive into bankruptcy all other players, an arrangement otherwise known as Tontine wagering scheme. And so it is in real life. If you examine the nature of economics in America today, you will see that everyone is competing for the same rationed amount of monopoly money called Federal Reserve notes and attempting to stay above water and avoid bankruptcy. This is, by definition, a de facto state of war between participants in both the board game and the game of life. The only way to stay in the game of monopoly and avoid bankruptcy is to obtain more monopoly money from other players. The only way to stay in the game of life and avoid bankruptcy is to somehow obtain more Federal Reserve notes from the other players around you. In both, the outcome is inevitable. The longest-running game of Monopoly lasted 70 days, but still ended the same way as all others before and since, with one player acquiring all the wealth and all the other players bankrupt. Unfortunately, there can be no other final conclusion in the Federal Reserve note game of life either, no matter how long you stretch it out, unless, of course, you simply stop volunteering to play the game. Volunteering. The most devastating form of volunteering occurs when someone promises, and people do this unflinchingly every single day, to be responsible for and pay the debts of another party. Believe it or not, this is how every unwary soul has sealed his fate, the trade name game. In other words, that which the content of this book is dedicated to exposing, untangling, and rectifying has an evil twin that works in concert with it. As you will discover toward the end of this article, the legal masters of the world are factually eminently aware of the distinction between your true name and the trade name, and have come up with an incredibly ingenious device for exploiting the difference without tipping their hand. The reason that every complaint unfailingly cites the defendant's respondent's name in all capital letters, the reason the name on every license is set in all capital letters, the reason the name on every Social Security card has been converted from English, as originally written on the application, into legalese, The reason that all banks insist on listing all accounts not in the true name of the party who walks in and fills out the forms, but in the artificial trade name associated therewith, is the same: to conduct business with you via an unknown, invisible, corporately colored artificial person that is subject to all statutory regulation and therefore under their complete control and power. The same applies equally when either of the two names is called out verbally. Remember, differently constructed names comprise distinct items of property, however similar. Filing a UCC financing statement is the first step in releasing yourself from these bonds. The second is cessation of volunteering to be responsible for the trade name's obligation by signing on its behalf. When someone signs his name on a commercial instrument listed in the straw man's trade name, he finalizes his financial obligations in that particular transaction and also contributes just that much more in the chosen master's designs for a new world order. That order is an economic pecking order, with them owning literally everything at the top and you and your family and friends owning nothing, including your labor, at the bottom. Article 3, Negotiable Instruments of the Uniform Commercial Code, has been written to augment the liabilities that come with signing on behalf of another, but has also been encrypted to keep curious slaves from finding out how they are being duped. Because the legal masters of the world cannot bind us into perpetual servitude without also offering a route for escape, we have remedy in the UCC. Unraveling the mystery. The key entry point into Article 3 of the subject of signatures is this. The general rule is that a signature is an endorsement. If the instrument does not indicate an unambiguous intent on the signer not to sign as an endorser, intent may be determined by words accompanying the signature, the place of signature, or other circumstances. UCC 3-204, Note 1, Paragraph 2. Even without defining the key term endorser, the meaning is clear. In the absence of indicating an unambiguous intent, a signature can be construed as an endorsement. Endorser, a person who makes an endorsement. UCC 3-204B. Endorsement means a signature, other than that of a signer as maker, drawer, or acceptor, that alone or accompanied by other words is made on an instrument for the purpose of 1. Negotiating the instrument, 2. Restricting payment of the instrument, or 3. Incurring endorser's liability on the instrument. But regardless of the intent of the signer, a signature and its accompanying words is an endorsement unless the accompanying words, terms of the instrument, place of the signature, or other circumstances unambiguously indicate that the signature was made for a purpose other than endorsement. For the purpose of determining whether a signature is made on an instrument, a paper affixed to the instrument is part of the instrument. UCC 3-204A. Makers, drawers, and acceptors are the primary types of signers of negotiable instruments. Maker means a person who signs or is identified in a note as a person undertaking to pay. UCC 3-1035. Drawer means a person who signs or is identified in a draft as a person ordering payment. UCC 3-1033. Acceptor means a drawee who has accepted a draft. UCC 3-1031. Drawee means a person ordered in a draft to make payment. UCC 3-1032. Accommodation parties. How could one sign a negotiable instrument, irrespective of the signer's awareness that what he is signing is a negotiable instrument, and incur liability as anything other than a maker, drawer, or acceptor? Answer: as an accommodation party. Accommodation party is described in Note 1 under UCC 3-419. An accommodation party is a person who signs an instrument to benefit the accommodated party, either by signing at the time value is obtained by the accommodated party or later. And who is not a direct beneficiary of the value obtained? An accommodation party will usually be a co-maker or anomalous endorser. In the UCC, one of the meanings of value is, essentially, credit. You qualify on this point because you have been the sole source of credit for your trade name since inception, birth, and are not a direct beneficiary of the value given. What you get is liability. The meaning of co-maker can be deduced from the definition of maker above, but is nevertheless a subordinate identifier in respect of accommodation party. Anomalous means departing from the common rule, irregular. The UCC defines anomalous endorsement as follows. Anomalous endorsement means an endorsement made by a person who is not the holder of the instrument. An anomalous endorsement does not affect the manner in which the instrument may be negotiated. UCC 3-205D. An anomalous endorsement is made by a party that is not the holder of the instrument. In other words, no rights in the instrument, and qualifies, nevertheless, as a valid endorsement, even though not specifically that of maker, drawer, or acceptor, and would not adversely affect the negotiability of the instrument. So this section is imbued with vagueness, opens the door for other factors to enter in. But we are not told what those factors might be, the purpose of codes. Summing up on accommodation party, someone who signs on behalf of another for the purpose of benefiting that party and who is also not a direct beneficiary of the value obtained by the accommodated party. An accommodation party is not a maker, not a drawer, and not an acceptor, but has an anomalous role in the endorsement process. Apparently, an accommodation party bears full liability for the accommodated party, but stands to gain nothing by participating. This is obviously the most inferior status one can have, because he is completely out of control of his own destiny based on the mischief that the trade name gets into and the misadventures that follow thereafter. Wrapping up on accommodated party, the worst kiss of death has been saved for last. An accommodation party is always a surety, UCC 3-419, note 3, paragraph 2. As you know from the course of co-suretyship in section 3, a surety is utterly responsible for anything and everything that the principal debtor is responsible for, including both payment and specific performance. An accommodation party is automatically and always a surety for the accommodated party. When you, the flesh and blood man/woman, sign an instrument, even if you do not know that you are signing a negotiable instrument, such as a traffic ticket, bearing the straw man's trade name, you are signing as an accommodation party, and bear full personal responsibility and accountability for whatever the straw man has gotten itself into, including the potential for incarceration. Remember, a surety is an equal of the principal. The creditor is authorized to treat the surety exactly as though the surety were the principal debtor, and extract both payment and specific performance. Since your straw man is rather difficult to locate and identify, no physical existence, you and your body serve nicely. Light at the end of the tunnel. Now for the $64 question. How can you avoid ever being considered as an accommodation party? Your signature ever being construed as an accommodation signature? The answer is found in notes 1 and 2 of section 3-402. Number 1. Subsection A states, when the represented person is bound on an instrument, if the instrument is signed by a representative, if under the law of agency, the represented person would be bound by the act of the representative in signing either the name of the represented person or that of the representative, the signature is the authorized signature of the represented person. 2. Subsection B1 states that if the form of the signature unambiguously shows that if it is made on behalf of an identified represented person, for example, P by A, treasurer, the agent is not liable. This is a workable standard for a court to apply. Translation. You're removed from the realm of liability of being construed as a maker, drawer, acceptor, or accommodation party, and therefore as a surety by unambiguously identifying your signature as that of authorized representative. Signing in this fashion removes all doubt, unambiguously indicates, the exact identification of the signing party. It also relieves the signer of all legal liability for the principal's, represented person's, obligation. The key is to be as unambiguous and as expositional as you can, to reveal as much as possible about your agency status and however little space you have to work with on the instrument. Writing above and below works also, as long as it is unambiguous. Some interchangeable examples of workable signatures are: also inserting the words authorized signature in a conspicuous, unambiguous manner, such as below the signature line, helps in indicating signer's agency status. Total confirmation from Big Brother of the validity of what we are doing. The final segment of this short essay reveals something that will convince even the fiercest naysayer, at least those who are not on Big Brother's payroll, of the correctness of our hunches and the criminal intent of the legal masters of the world. Looking at Note 3 of UCC 3-402, which has to do with checks, we find Subsection 3 is directed at the check cases. It states that if the check identifies the represented person, the agent who signs does not have to indicate agency status. Virtually all checks used today are in personalized form, which identify the person on whose account the check is drawn. In this case, nobody is deceived into thinking that the person signing the check is meant to be liable. Therefore, apparently, when the name of the represented person is printed on the face of the check, any agent signing for the represented person need not indicate agency status. Virtually all checks used today are personalized to identify the account holder, and since virtually all checks used today are personalized, nobody is deceived into thinking that the person signing the check is meant to be liable if he is signing as an agent. Follow this procedure. Go online and pull up www.deluxe.com. Under Personal Checks, check on Browse, our full line of check designs. Wait a few moments while the next page, Deluxe Personal Checks Catalog, comes up. Click on About Checks and then scroll down to Check Security Features and observe the arrow marked Microprinting and pointing at the signature line of the check. Next, take out one of your personal, not business, checks and place it under a magnifying glass or microscope. Place it so the signature line is directly under the lens. Below is a blow-up of what you will see when you scrutinize the line. Authorized signature, editing note 3 of UCC 3-402 from above. In this case, nobody except the signer is deceived into thinking that the person signing the check is meant to be liable. Deluxe openly prints out the words authorized signature underneath the signature line of business checks, but disguises the same proclamation on personal checks. The reason the signature line on a personal check is made up of words authorized signature is because it is a physical impossibility that the account holder will ever sign the check. The account holder is an artificial person, in other words, John Henry Doe in all caps, and exists in name only. The Fed knows that every signature appearing on a personal check is the signature of the flesh and blood agent, the authorized representative. However, this fact must be concealed in order to cause a signer to believe that he is the principal when he actually signs as accommodation party, in other words, surety, and therefore 100% liable for everything the principal is liable for. This applies in every signature on every document, not just personal checks. Deluxe and other check manufacturing companies must do this if they want to sell personal checks to Fed customers. Apparently, this is how the Fed justifies their deceit and duplicity. We told them. We put it right there on the check leaf. We can't help it if they're too stupid to know that they are not the authorized representative. When they decided to accept responsibility as the accommodation party for the account holder, they did so voluntarily. We can't help it if they volunteer to do something. We did everything we could to make it easier for them. We even personalized the checks with the account holder's name and spelled it out, authorized signature, right there on the signature line to save them the headache of having to write out authorized representative every time they signed a check. We can't be blamed for their ignorance. We were not supposed to find out about this device, but its existence is a full-blown confession, an acknowledgement, and validation of everything propounded in this book, re: the distinction between true name and trade name. Big Brother knows precisely what it is doing, re: subjugating us via the names. Welcome to the real world. Your signature. If UCC, delineated check signing procedures, are so important for Federal Reserve owners and the manufacturers of checks used within that system, it should be important for you as well. The overwhelming significance of Fed acknowledgement of the difference between the names by virtue of the inclusion of this artifice on every check cannot be exaggerated. In fact, this discovery alone is conclusive proof of their deceit in every controversy involving the trade name. Remember, the Fed literally owns the government, and therefore everything in America. This is confirmed in Senate Document 43, 73rd Congress, First Session. See entry by the same name in glossary. The message: you do not have to continue to volunteer to be responsible for the trade name's obligations, financial and otherwise. You can begin affixing your signature in the proper fashion now that you know the truth. You can always prove that you are nothing more than the authorized rep merely by pointing out the statement made on the signature line of your checking account. This phenomenon has unlimited application in your life. It is so profound that if someone were to be arrested and subsequently asked to sign a bond, he could do so as set forth above and incur zero liability for ever having to do with either the bond or the criminal charge associated therewith. The distinction between the parties is undeniable. In closing, the check signature line subterfuge can be used to prove the legal correctness of what we are doing with anyone, including a stubborn Secretary of State who refuses to file a financing statement based on the hackneyed ruse that you are contracting with yourself. If there were no difference between trade name and true name, the Fed would not have taken such extreme measures to conceal the fact that the signer of a personal check is only the agent. This revelation should bring about a sharp improvement in the lives of former slaves whenever a signature is required.
Even the massive U.S. bank J.P. Morgan is now asking the question, is the U.S. dollar soon going to lose its status as the world reserve currency? Or as they put it, will we soon lose this exorbitant privilege? I want to unpack that term real quickly, exorbitant privilege. I think it's important to understand that in the time that the U.S. dollar has been the world reserve currency of the world, I'm talking post-World War II and after the Bretton Woods Agreement, the U.S., not only the U.S. dollar, but the U.S. citizens, the government, has benefited immensely from that status. I mean, first of all, there's the buying stuff side of it. I'm talking imports. You know, because the U.S. dollar is used worldwide for trade, and because of the demand that's generated by central banks holding a majority of their Forex holdings in U.S. dollar terms, it's allowed us to basically import cheap goods for decades and decades, whether it's goods from China or Japan or South Korea or Vietnam or wherever it is. Historically, the dollar has bought a lot in those countries, and it's bought a lot of goods for us to import, right? We're infamous for running this massive trade imbalance, this trade deficit, where we spend and spend and spend, and what do we export? Dollars. And that only works if the dollar itself is a world reserve currency. But then there's the other side of it. There's the debt side of it as well. Because we can issue debt in our own currency, the world reserve currency, at the government level, that enables us to take on a very large amount of debt. Now, I'm not going to say the U.S. has the highest amount of debt as a percentage of GDP. We know that there's some European countries and Japan that are far ahead of us. But Glenn, we're talking like, what is it now, $22.5 trillion of debt. That is very difficult to wrap your mind around. And it likely wouldn't be possible if the U.S. dollar was not the world reserve currency. And so for this to change, needless to say, I don't think I need to tell you guys that there's going to be some serious shakeups in everything ranging from the Forex markets, obviously, to the sovereign bond markets, the U.S. bond markets, and the stock markets, commodities, etc. Now, what J.P. Morgan in here is talking about is a shift east in terms of economic dominance, right? And this goes back many centuries, right? For much of the, I don't know, 15, 16, 1700s, Western Europe and Europe as a whole was sort of the economic center of the world. Not to say that they're, you know, China, we know for a very long time had a very large economy, very large population. Japan to some extent did as well, right? And then there's the Middle East and there's, you know, Northern Africa and whatnot. But come on, I mean, Europe was what some people would call the center of civilization, or at least the center of Western civilization at the time, right? Eastern civilization was no longer separated at that point, but trade was relatively minimal. And as far as Western civilization is concerned, they were the powerhouse economies. I'm talking the UK eventually, but Spain and Germany and the Netherlands and Prussia and all these other countries. I don't even know if Germany was around back then, right, for some of this time, because it probably would have been a part of a different country. But France, you know, all of these countries, Italy, were all part of this economic powerhouse. But over time, that shifted east, right? I'm talking mostly World War One and on. It moved across the Atlantic to the United States. And all of a sudden, the U.S., we had our roaring 20s, and then we had our Great Depression, which was kind of a worldwide event. But then after that, we had World War II, Bretton Woods Agreement, etc. And the U.S. came out of World War II ahead of everyone else. It's pretty obvious, right? And again, the economic center of the world had shifted east. Well, it's doing that again. It's shifting east again. And you know, to some extent, this started probably back in the 80s, the 70s, right, with Japan's rapid growth. But in this case, I'm talking about mostly in the past 10 years, right, maybe past 20 years if you want to go back a little further. China, right? China is an economic powerhouse. And again, economic activity is shifting east. Now, this article by JP Morgan suggests diversifying out of the U.S. dollar into things like commodities, precious metals, which oftentimes is kind of in that category, and emerging market currencies, right? I don't think this article is suggesting that because China is sort of the economic powerhouse of the world right now, or you know, second to the United States, that eventually the U.S. dollar is going to fall as a world reserve currency and that the Chinese yuan is going to replace it. It's not ready for that. That's very unlikely to happen. However, I think what they would agree with and what I would say is that over time what we're going to see is some sort of mechanism or basket of currencies that will replace the U.S. dollar. No longer will it be a U.S. dollar system worldwide. Rather, it'll be something similar to the SDR, right, which will be used for trade or for something along those lines. Now, that's not a done deal. We see that in today's world. There's an increasing number of fractures between countries, right? We see fractures forming between allies that have been allies for decades or hundreds of years, right? Whether it's between the U.S. and in parts of Europe, right? Or different European countries and Turkey and NATO and you know, the list goes on and on. I think it's like, you know, the truth of the matter is that what we'll see eventually is more and more de-dollarization, and that we'll see more and more countries take up some of their own currencies, local currencies for trade, right? For example, the, you know, Russia and China, they can do trade in yuan and or rubles, right? Or China and Japan, right? Yen and yuan, et cetera. I think that's what we'll see. And that's essentially what I would call de-dollarization, countries choosing to use some other currency or mechanism than the U.S. dollar or the SWIFT system. And I think this is going to increasingly become prevalent. It's not going to happen overnight. This U.S. dollar collapse is not going to happen overnight. I think it's ongoing, but it will be something that will develop, I think, over the next couple of years. And what really will I think, destroy the U.S. dollar, what will ultimately make it a currency that no longer can be called the world reserve currency, is not just this de-dollarization, and it's not just the U.S. using our foreign policy or economic power as a tool of diplomacy, thus driving away some of these other countries. It's going to be debt, right? It's going to be debt at the sovereign level, ultimately, as well as corporate and consumer level. But people are going to realize at some point that, hey, the U.S. dollar is only going to be able to sustain this amount of this spending and these deficits with constant money printing, monetization by the Fed. And once that happens, once that realization is made by the broader marketplace, then I think we can definitively say that this is the beginning of the end for the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency. As always, I'd like to thank you from the bottom of my heart for watching this video, listening to this podcast, and God bless.
Lecture 4, Monetary History of the United States.
In the last lecture, we talked about the views of Steve Forbes and Ron Paul that the United States would be better off if it returned to the practice of backing currency with gold. Some of what motivates supporters of a return to the gold standard is concern about the power wielded by the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States and those who run it. The proper role of the federal government in monetary and banking affairs was debated early and often in the history of the United States. The federal government tried twice in the 19th century and failed both times to create a central bank that would oversee other banks and maintain a national currency. The question of whether or not a national bank would concentrate too much power in the hands of too few occupied the founding fathers as they wrote the Constitution and considered legislation in the first sessions of Congress. The connection of this concern about the abuse of power to the use of gold as money is straightforward. If gold coins are money, then anyone who has gold has money. While mints converted bullion to coins, citizens typically had the right and sometimes the obligation to trade their bullion to the mint for gold coins. If, on the other hand, a national bank was able to issue paper money, then those who controlled the bank could increase or decrease the quantity of money in circulation without reference to the availability of gold or any other scarce commodity. That ability is power, and it is power that some of our forefathers feared. But others of our forefathers believed that creation of a national bank and paper money were essential to the development of our nation. Today, we shall see that disagreements about financial arrangements in the United States were tantamount to disagreements between competing visions for our new nation. Imagine, it is December of 1790, and you are visiting the third session of the first Congress of the United States. The ink is barely dry on the Constitution, which was adopted on September 17, 1787, but not finally ratified by Rhode Island, the last state to do so, until May 29, 1790. What will you see? What you will witness as you visit Congress on this particular day is a debate on a proposal offered by Alexander Hamilton, Secretary of the Treasury, to charter a national bank, the Bank of the United States, which we now refer to, as we'll see, as the First Bank of the United States. The Senate passed Hamilton's bill authorizing the bank on January 20, 1791. The House, after much heated debate, approved the bank by a vote of 39 to 20, with most of the yes votes coming from New England, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. President Washington at first seemed to be convinced that the bill was contrary to the Constitution. He had gone so far as to instruct James Madison to prepare a veto. However, Hamilton counterargued that the purpose of the Constitution was to set up a workable government for the United States. Hamilton argued that government had the power and the right to employ, quote, all means requisite and fairly applicable to the attainment of the ends of such power, provided that they were not precluded by the Constitution itself and not, quote, contrary to the essential ends of political society, end quote. What Hamilton meant was that the United States, in order to fulfill its potential as a great commercial nation, required financial and monetary systems that would facilitate payments and trade. Well, Washington was convinced by Hamilton's argument and signed the act incorporating the bank on February 25, 1791. The bank was located in Philadelphia. After temporary location at the Carpenter's Hall on Chestnut Street, the bank moved in 1797 around the corner to its permanent and present location on 3rd Street between Chestnut and Walnut in a building designed by Samuel Blodgett. When you go to Philadelphia, take a look. It's still there. The forces arrayed in favor of and in opposition to the Bank of the United States mirrored, as I've said, competing visions for the evolution of our nation. So what were some arguments in opposition to the bank? Well, some opposed the bank on the grounds that the Constitution did not explicitly permit the federal government to create a bank or issue paper money. The Constitution authorized the federal government to coin and forbade the states from doing so. The Constitution forbade the states from issuing paper money, but was silent as to what the federal government might do. The Constitution forbade the states to make anything but gold and silver legal tender, but omitted to say what the federal government might do. The Constitution likewise forbade the states from impairing contracts. Now, this latter prohibition is monetary in nature because the depreciation of legal tender paper money was thought to violate contracts. Some opposed the creation of a bank explicitly because they were opposed to the issuance of paper money. They feared that paper money would invariably lead to schemes where debtors increase their wealth at the expense of creditors. Indeed, the United States had ample experience with currency depreciation. The Continental Congress issued paper money, it was called Continentals, to finance the Revolutionary War. And by the end of the war, Continentals were essentially worthless. Some opposed creation of the bank because they were opposed to the federal government setting up perpetual institutions, which they considered to be a hallmark of British government and a threat to personal liberty. An agrarian representative from Georgia, James Jackson, demanded, quote, "Was it not the ecclesiastical corporations and perpetual monopolies of England and Scotland that drove our forefathers to this country?" Some opposed the creation of the bank because they thought that it was a threat to the agrarian way of life that they believed was the best way forward for the United States. Thomas Jefferson, in particular, argued for a self-sufficient way of life that eschewed trade, especially trade for European manufactured goods. With all that opposition, could there be offsetting support? Yes. Yes. Some, and notably Hamilton, favored creation of the bank because they favored the development of a commercial United States. Indeed, one of the reasons that the Articles of Confederation proved unworkable was that individual states interfered with cross-state trade. In the Constitution, those committed to commercial activities sought arrangements that promoted trade and commercial growth. Some favored creation of the bank explicitly because they favored the creation of paper money. Why? For many rural Americans, economic activity amounted to raising crops and bartering surplus crops with neighbors. While these individuals were industrious, they rarely exchanged their labor or its fruits for gold and silver. These farmers were frightened that if taxes were specified to be paid in gold, that they might lose their lands because they didn't have access to gold. One of the complaints of Daniel Shays and those who participated in Shays' rebellion was that creditors demanded payment in gold and silver when there was not enough specie in Massachusetts to pay the claims. Some favored creation of the bank because they agreed with Hamilton's interpretation of the Constitution cited earlier. While Congress and President Washington allowed creation of the bank in 1791, a later Congress allowed its charter to lapse 20 years later in 1811. In 1791, when the Bank of the United States was established, there was no banking system in the United States. There were four isolated systems centered in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Baltimore. But after the establishment of the Bank of the United States, the various systems coalesced into a single system that exchanged one another's obligations and maintained ongoing debtor-creditor relationships. The Bank of the United States functioned a lot like a central bank because of the Bank of the United States was the main government depository. It ended up as an important creditor to state and local banks. It lent those state and local banks money. And because it was their creditor, the Bank of the United States had the power to regulate local banks by pressing them for payments. Do what I want, or I'll make you pay sooner. Some important individuals did not like the discipline imposed by the Bank of the United States. Famously, John Jacob Astor of New York was furious because the bank had denied him credit. The third and fourth presidents of the United States, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, had opposed the creation of the bank in the first place and had not changed their minds by the time their presidencies began. And some continued to dislike the fact that some of the shareholders in the Bank of the United States happened to be British. There was a bill to extend the charter of the Bank of the United States, and it was tabled by the House in a vote of 65-64 and defeated in the Senate by a vote of 18-17, with Vice President George Clinton casting the deciding vote. Clearly, the country remained divided, and closely divided at that, on the role of the federal government in banking and financial matters. Important constituencies continued to disagree about whether the bank was an important and appropriate source of financial discipline, or whether, on the other hand, it amounted to an infringement by the federal government on states' rights and individual rights. The forces that favored a bank tried again and succeeded 5 years later to establish a second Bank of the United States in 1860. But this arrangement did not go well. Unlike the first bank that had been ably run by Albert Gallatin, the second bank had operational difficulties almost from its beginning. Essentially, and very importantly, the second bank behaved perversely. Here's an example. A panic and a recession swept the United States in 1818. But the bank, rather than extending credit to offset these recessionary forces, was forced by its own lack of reserves to call in credit and intensify the recession, the exact opposite of what we would expect a central bank to do today. The death of the Second Bank of the United States came at the hands of none other than President Andrew Jackson, who believed that it was corrupt and wanted it to cease operations even before its charter expired in 1836. Some political analysts likened Jackson's effort to those of a gallant knight doing battle with some monster. Jackson instructed the Secretary of the Treasury to deposit federal tax receipts in state banks. Think about that. Deposit the own receipts of the federal government, not in the federal bank, but in state banks. So, not surprisingly, the second bank began to run at a loss and was converted to a regular bank when its charter was not renewed and went bankrupt several years later. So for a time, the federal government was not a front and center in national financial matters. But it's said that necessity is often the mother of invention. And as we shall see, the necessity in this case for government revenues brought the United States back into the business of banking. The time is the Civil War between the states. And the need for revenue on the part of the federal government finally settled the debate about federal involvement in financial matters. The federal government did not in particular resume control over the monetary system in the United States until the National Banking Acts of 1863 and 1864. At the beginning of Abraham Lincoln's presidency, Treasury Secretary Salmon Chase had on hand approximately $2 million, a tiny, tiny fraction of what Congress had appropriated to begin war preparations, and an even smaller fraction of what he thought was necessary to prosecute the war. In 1861, the U.S. government suspended payment in gold. We've seen this before in our lectures. In 1862, it issued new legal tender paper currency that were called greenbacks. Backside was green. The National Banking Act of 1863 and 1864 created a system of federally chartered banks called national banks that were supervised by the newly created Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. That office still exists. National banks were required to purchase treasury bonds as a condition of their establishment. So national banks were required to lend money to the federal government. What did they get in return? They were then allowed to issue greenbacks for up to 90% of their bond holdings. So we have a new national currency and banks can issue it if they lend to the federal government. These two banking acts also created a tax of 10% on banknotes issued by state chartered banks. And the intent, quite plainly, was to drive state chartered banks out of existence. Many of these state chartered banks did convert to national banks, but some survived by accepting deposits rather than by issuing notes. According to Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz in their Monetary History of the United States, 192 million dollars worth of national banknotes were in circulation in 1867. The creation of the first U.S. dollar can be fairly said to be a byproduct of the federal government's desire for a source of revenue to finance military action during the Civil War. In the last quarter of the 19th century, two important questions faced the United States. When would it return to the gold standard? And would it permit the coining of silver? 100 years after Congress debated the question of whether to create the Bank of the United States, Congress continued to be divided on the appropriate role of the federal government in financial matters. Once again, the issue of what would be money was hotly contested. And once again, like in Andrew Jackson's time, a prominent politician became known for his stand on monetary issues. During the greenback period, there was a dual monetary standard, with both greenbacks and gold circulating as forms of payment. But there was no fixed trading ratio or exchange rate of one for the other because the U.S. government did not offer to exchange gold for greenbacks at some fixed price of gold. So, not surprisingly, the price of gold in terms of greenbacks rose dramatically during the years of the Civil War. Currency became less valuable in terms of gold. Gold became more valuable in terms of the currency. Once the war ended, the greenback price of gold did decline gradually, and by 1872, it was only about 10% higher than it had been in 1861. So with those two prices coming close together, it raised the question, when would the U.S. return to the gold standard? As the U.S. paid off its war debt, and the greenback price of gold came closer to its pre-war level, debate was touched off about when the U.S. would return to the gold standard. And there was debate about whether the United States should allow the coining of silver as well as gold. Let's reflect on this a little bit, because this is important. From the Coinage Act of 1792, either silver or gold were legally money in the United States. Okay? So from 1792, one could have gold coins or silver coins circulating in the United States. Until 1834, however, only silver circulated as money. What's wrong with gold? Well, it's a simple answer. Gold was too expensive, and people had an incentive to melt down gold coins in order to use the metal itself. Silver coins they left in the form of coins. In 1834, there was some new legislation, and it replaced the 15-to-1 ratio of silver to gold, which had been set down in the 1792 Act, with a new ratio, 16-to-1. What does that mean? Well, in 1792, a unit of value in silver had to have 15 times as much metal as a unit of value in terms of gold. So a dollar silver coin would have 15 times the weight of a dollar gold coin. In 1834, that was changed to a 16-to-1 ratio. That legislation ended silver's dominance as money and made gold the metal of choice for coinage. So as the U.S. was poised to leave the greenback and return to a metal standard, the question was, which metal? Gold, silver, or both? The issue was settled by the U.S. Coinage Act of 1873, which eliminated free coinage of silver and cast the die for the gold standard in the United States. The Coinage Act caused little controversy when it was approved, but it proved itself to be very bad medicine for the U.S. economy during the last quarter of the 19th century. Indeed, Milton Friedman has termed the act, the quote-unquote crime of 1873. Strong language. What was the nature of the crime? Gold became very scarce, with the price of gold to silver more than doubling between 1873 and 1900. The elimination of silver from the money stock caused the money supply to grow too slowly to keep pace with potential output growth in the United States. As a result, prices in the United States fell from 1876 to 1896 at a rate, on average, of 1.5% per year. Think about that for a minute. 20 years of price deflation at 1.5% on average per year. Now, this fall in prices hit farmers particularly hard. As the price of their crops fell, while the price of what they bought fell less rapidly. Milton Friedman blames that Coinage Act for bad recessions that occurred in 1892 to 1894, a second bad recession in 1895 to 1896, and he blames that act for the banking panic of 1893. Increasing the money supply more rapidly through the resumption of silver coinage was a crucial issue in the presidential campaign of 1896. William Jennings Bryan delivered the famous Cross of Gold speech at the Democratic National Convention held in Chicago. Jennings said, "If they dare to come out in the open field and defend the gold standard as a good thing, we shall fight them to the utmost. Having behind us the producing masses of the nation and the world, having behind us the commercial interests and the laboring interests, and all the toiling masses. We shall answer their demands for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold. William McKinley defeated Bryan in 1896 and again in 1900. But the silver issue continued on even into the imagination of the American people. If you've read Frank Baum's book, The Wizard of Oz, you will know that it is a monetary allegory. What's the evidence? The slippers are not ruby. That was a device of Hollywood. Dorothy's slippers are silver. And Dorothy wears silver slippers as she trips her way toward Oz along a gold-colored road. The role of the federal government in monetary affairs was, perhaps, settled finally with the passage of the Federal Reserve Act in December of 1913 and the establishment of the Federal Reserve in the following year. But I find it fascinating that the proper role of government in monetary and banking affairs was debated early and often throughout our history. The federal government tried twice before the Federal Reserve Act to create a central bank that would regulate banks and maintain a national currency. Debate on the proper limits of federal authority in monetary affairs is hardly over. The Federal Reserve broke new ground in expanding the role that it took upon itself in monetary affairs during the Great Recession of 2007 through 9. Debate has raged on whether or not the Fed did too much. Let me leave you with a final question. Suppose that you had not only visited Congress, but that you had been a member there in 1791, or in 1816, or in 1863, or in 1873. How would you have voted on chartering the First Bank of the United States? How would you have voted on chartering the Second Bank of the United States? How would you have voted on allowing the federal government to create the greenback? And how would you have voted on barring silver as a coin metal? Thank you.
Greetings, greetings, greetings. You are now tuned into the vault. Trust Christian, own nothing, control everything. Just want to thank you for tuning in live or listening in a replay. Back once again, 2019, with another episode of the vault, 100% Private Money 101. Excited about this episode and talking to you all. It's been a missing for me. I know it's been a missing for a lot of other individuals. And I know it's going to be a lot of people tuning in and wanting to actually connect with us tonight. So I'm really excited. Thank you, Lorenzo Warren. Thank you, AUIG Davis. We're just going to do a bunch of thank yous as well. So I'm really excited about the audience tonight. And I appreciate all of you all sending us emails. Thank you, Gustavo, for tuning in live. Appreciate you. And look forward to it. Ernest Robinson, so excited. It's a pleasure, everyone, to be back. So I know everyone is new to the vault. You guys may be hearing me doing an extended greeting tonight or today, wherever you are in the world, just because the absence of Trust Christian in the vault. A. Kent, thank you for tuning in live. Ernest Robinson, it's just been, it's been a while. 2018 has some time to kind of do some things and grow to the next level, and it's been a joy. A bunch of families have been impacted by the vault, in a positive way. The community has grown, and that's where the attention has been. It's been focused in the private, because the private is where all the power is. And so that's why today it's rather important to come back out in 2019 and talk about and address the 100% private money, because a lot of individuals have been educated in public money and public funds, but who knows about the private money and or equity. And so there are two sets of information in it, ladies and gentlemen. There's public and there's private. And so today we're just going to go over and discuss the private education that individuals receive or families receive at the vault, and what you can look forward to in private trustee training. So really exciting, and we're going to be going over that today, particularly about private money. And the reason why I thought this was an exceptional topic to come back out and talk about in 2009, thanks Trey Stone for tuning in live, missed you as well. The reason why I thought it was important to talk about private money, once again, is because there's two types of education. There's private and there's public. But, you know, I want to give you all some family names that you all can see that are inside the vault and are, have their own vault. Individuals and families such as the Rothschilds, such as the Morgans, such as the Rockefellers. They all practice what's called own nothing, control everything. And these are families that have banking cartels internationally. Thanks Rashad and B for tuning in live, and B Alexandria, excuse me. And I really wanted to share with you all, you know, I know you all look at the Forbes list. That's a relatively public information source of wealth. But I would challenge you all to think about what makes you think that the Rothschilds, one of the largest banking families in the world, is not, why are they not on the Forbes list? You know, is it because they're not American? But when we look at the Morgans, when we look at the Rockefellers were actually in the United States. The Carnegies were actually in the United States. And once again, they practiced a thing called own nothing, control everything, which all wealth is held inside of the trust. All wealth is held inside of the private. This is why you hear so many wealthy families inside of trust. It's because the practice having money inside of a own nothing, control everything perspective, inside a private money scenario. Thank you, Vincent, for tuning in live. So let's just kind of talk about that tonight. Before your eyes every single day. Here we go, ladies and gentlemen. Private education, first thing you learned in our private community, it's all about jurisdiction. What jurisdiction is the money in? Everyone on this line and this stream knows there's a difference between a public corporation and a private corporation. But most people don't know how a private corporation is formed, but they know how to go down and file at the Secretary of State and go get a public corporation. What is a private corporation? Ladies and gentlemen, that's a corporation that's held in trust. That is a corporation where you look at, we'll go through the first family of example, the Gates family right now. Everyone that's in America used to know that Bill Gates used to be what's called the richest man in the world. But Bill Gates was the richest man in the world before he learned own nothing, control everything. He went through his tax situation. And then you saw the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And then you saw Microsoft make its largest dividend distribution of money, public money, once again, from a public corporation that's publicly traded on the stock market to a private family foundation. $1 billion dividend distribution given tax-free. $1 billion plus. And has been going on for years because that's called private money, 100% private money. You all can go look up the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. You can go see that it is a private family foundation. It's not a public foundation. It's a private foundation. Why is it a private foundation? Because it's held in trust. All of that money is held in trust. It's in a private trust. So, let's talk about this private money. How is it held privately? It's held in a trust. Well, what is a trust? A trust is a contract. And let's look at the law of contracts. The law of contracts says contract makes the law. Let's learn how we can use an old-time strategy by the elite to create and pass on generational wealth tax-free. Because when that money goes into that private family foundation, it's given tax-free. It's a 501c3 entity. It's a charity. There are public charities and there are private charities. There's public money and there's private money. So I wanted to share this with you all today because I know a lot of individuals say, oh, I want to go private. I want to be private. First rule of being private, own nothing, control everything. There's a gentleman, as I've traveled, I saw that there's a gentleman. His name is, let me get his name back up real quick for you all. This gentleman's name, J.B. Pritzker. Go ahead and put it in the chat for you all. If you're not on the chat, you'll get a chance to, hopefully get a chance to see it. Pritzker, he's actually running for, I think this is governor, in Chicago. And so, this individual is a billionaire. And I like this article that I read about him because it talks about private money. First of all, a blind trust would imply that whatever's going on is private. Thank you, Colby, for tuning in live. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in live. If I haven't talked to you live, please feel free to shout us out and say hello. Why is this so imperative? He's a billionaire, but he's running for public office. And I was talking to a trustee, a senior trustee, about this the other day. And we were talking about how when you run for public office, there has to be a level of disclosure that's given to the public. First of all, if you don't own anything, how do you live in a multi-million dollar house? How do you have jets? How do you have $200,000 vehicles in your driveway if you don't own anything? Well, when you go into the public to hold a public office, there's certain levels of disclosure that have to be given. This man has a family estate. His family estate has been now appointed Northern Trust Company. So as you can see, there's a third party now. They're an independent trustee over the assets that this individual in their family estate, private money, was held. But because this individual wants to go into a public office, there has to be a certain level of disclosure in the public. He's not actually running for a Chicago governor. He's running for Illinois, because you can't be a governor, I think, of a city. You have to be governor of a state. So I just want to be clear. I don't want anyone to make any comments on the back end as if I'm not knowledgeable of that. Earl Monroe, appreciate you for tuning in live. And so you all can look up J.B. Pritzker. I put it in the chat. And I wanted to share with you another individual, the President of the United States currently, Donald Trump. We've been talking about this since he's been elected. This individual said, I don't have any tax returns to show. Well, how are you a billionaire riding around on a jet? You got a multi-million dollar house that you live in, but you don't own it. You don't even have a tax return to show that you can afford to live in it. It's called private money, 100% private money. And this is 101. Private money 101 says you have to own nothing, control everything. Family trusts are erected. For all of you all that want to do community building, that's through a private real estate investment trust. That's through a private family trust. See, there's two types of trust. There's two types of everything. They got the public and they got the private. So you all say, well, give me an example of what the public one is. Just one example. It's called Social Security. Social Security is for the public welfare, the public funds. Everything that's public goes into Social Security. Everything that private, as private, goes into the private. Jack Bone, thanks for tuning in live. So, thanks, Jackbone. I appreciate the comment. So, I just really wanted to go over that today. I'm actually open for questions. My messages are never long nowadays. They're very, very brief, very straight, very to the point of letting you all know. Individuals, when individuals say, well, if there's two different types of contracts, public contracts and private contracts, did you all know that contract law is private law? That's why you don't get that education in public school. Did you know the law library is waiting for you? That's a private environment. That's made for individuals that want to learn how to protect their private rights. See, I'll probably have just have to do an episode about is privacy under attack, because it's not. Even though you all have seen, why is it public? Because, no sound. Okay, Vincent Terry, thanks. Thanks, Vincent Terry. Thanks, Big Smile. Newbie, Vincent, can you hear me? Alrighty, thank you, Vincent. So I don't know where I fell off, Vincent, but I'm going to start back out about is privacy under attack? Is private money attack? It's not under attack. Why? Because the same individual that everyone had an issue with in the public, talking about he's taking their private pictures and their private everything and releasing it to the public and selling it, the same agreement, which is a private contract that you agreed to, you as a private person, I shouldn't call you a private person because a person is a corporation. It's an association, and it's a trust. It's an entity. It's a dead entity. So, the same individual you guys may be questioning whether your privacy is under attack through Facebook, this individual did the same thing that Bill Gates did. As soon as he started making the billions, where did the money go? How was it set up? It was set up inside of a private family foundation. That's why you see the Zuckerberg Foundation. That's a private family foundation. So for all you all that want 501c3s, you want private entities, how does the money go directly from Facebook Incorporated, which is a public entity? Thanks, Bo, for tuning in live. How does the money go directly from a public corporation into a private family foundation? Complete tax write-off. Zuckerberg's enjoying that jet, having property over there in Hawaii. He doesn't own it. He controls it. Yeah, you got to have a good team of lawyers. That's what they always say. But how come you guys got to go to a public?
Version of tissues forming organisms like particles splitting, I'm volatile, be wary of me. The spawn of the sun and the earth, be born on hollow ground, messed around and open up a goddamn portal spitting. They call me beast because I'm greasing rappers on they turf and plot revolts. They'll quote me later, say I hardly spoke, cause I'm a quiet assassin with passion for fire. Blaze the trails and leave the victims catching breath inside the smoke. This the revival of that fiber rap, Harlem City, epitome of street survival rap, hard and gritty. A law's math with a swag they can't master. Cast from the blast of the Elohim, God is with me. I spark fear in their hearts with 50,000 watts of light beams from out the deepest chasms of the darkness.